Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And with me, I have some magnificent professorial and academic colleagues. We're going to discuss exhaustion, a very demanding topic. Now, just a week ago, I was in Tokyo, Japan, with my whole court, the first time any court has met with another court in a joint judicial conference anywhere in the world. Rather historic meeting, and I could get all excited about that event. But let me just, we had a mock hearing at that proceeding. The Japanese court heard a case, and we heard the identical case. And the case was one chosen by the chief judge of the Federal Circuit, and it involved exhaustion. Now, at that hearing, we picked the best lawyers from both countries, and one of those lawyers started with the following hypothetical that I'm going to hit these colleagues with. I'm in Japan on a trip with my court, and I notice that I don't have a watch, and I need one to keep the court running on time. I buy a watch at the local store. Unbeknownst to me, it has an infringing chip in it. Now, brethren, when I return to the United States, am I an infringer? Moreover, a year later, when I notice that it's running slow and I take it in for repairs, have I infringed a second time? Maybe that's kind of an intriguing little hypothetical that'll get us started. What we're going to do is give each of our panelists 5, 6, 7 minutes to introduce their take on this issue, and then it'll be a free-for-all, and the free-for-all includes you. I'd hope that as soon as they finish, I see 6 hands, and we'll just have an open conversation here. But we're going to start with Professor Keefe. Scott is a magnificent professor at George Washington Law School. He's also a senior fellow at the Stanford University Hoover Institution. I remember him most fondly as one of the last clerks to Circuit Judge Giles Rich, one of the legends of my court, where I can tell you he made marvelous contributions to our jurisprudence, as well as those he's made since his professorial activities. Professor Keefe.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chief, for those kind words and for the great hypothetical. I think that the hypothetical does ask us to ask the hard question. It does ask us to dig deep. And as we think about digging deep, let me hit back with another hypothetical. In the United States, descend from a tribe of people who have populated North America since human beings walked on North America, and you dig down deep into your land that you own in fee simple as your ancestors have owned since human beings walked here. So I'm making the best case for ownership of stuff, clearest chain of title. And you don't go to the library, and you don't have access to the interwebs, and you don't talk to other people, but you're really smart. And you dig down into this land you own, and using your own ingenuity, you assemble something. Let's call it a widget. If I happen to have a patent on that widget, you infringe. Doesn't matter how clean your title is to the stuff, And it doesn't matter how independent your origination is, patent law in the United States and in most of the rest of the world is designed to say the patentee has a right to exclude you from doing what is covered by the patent, and your access to the information and your access to the stuff are totally irrelevant to the question of whether you infringe. Either the patent's valid or not, and you infringe or not, but the infringement question is unrelated to the ownership question, even in the best case of ownership and even in the best case of independent creation. And so if that's the answer domestically, and if that's the answer in the best case for your ownership, then it must be the answer when you buy something overseas that has nothing to do with the patents in the United States or in any other countries where you might encounter a patent. And yes, when you then bring the thing into the second country, you now have an infringing article. Now, my next response would be, who cares? There are massive, massive numbers of infringements that occur in this country, large numbers of low-value acts of infringement, and our society does not grind to a halt because of it. Cats and dogs don't live together. Government continues to operate. The world continues to turn, and life moves on. Markets and property rights can be totally robust without having them so perfectly enforced that the transaction costs and the holdup problems and the two bites at the apple or four bites at the apple problem that many people will talk about later today, those problems don't actually creep in even though there are acts of infringement. So the bigger issue is, can commercial players arbitrage and game a system of intellectual property rights in multiple countries by buying at a low price and selling at a high price? And if you allow that, and that's what many of these cases are about, big commercial players arbitraging different pricing systems, then what you do is you stop price discrimination. And we, in our progressive, pluralist society, are totally correct in being quite skeptical about many forms of discrimination, but we happen to be totally delighted with most forms of price discrimination. Many of you flew here on an airplane, and you could look at the seat, look at the person sitting in the seat next to you on the flight and compare your price tickets, and I bet you did not pay the same price, and yet you got the same rather modest service. You arrived the same 1 hour late. You sat on the tarmac for the same extra hour, and they said thank you in the same way. Price discrimination is something that we view as quite constructive because it increases access to whatever is being sold, and in fact, it does so in a way that is generally thought to be quite efficient. So exhaustion, which is a funny term I'll talk about in a second, and international exhaustion, these are terms that the way they get used interfere with something everyone should like, which is productive, efficiency-enhancing price discrimination. International exhaustion should make no sense as a matter of doctrine because IP rights are national in scope, so you're not using your patent in Japan when you sell a product in Japan. Sorry, you're not using your U.S. patent in Japan when you sell a product in Japan. And when the product comes to the U.S., it now should encounter the U.S. patent. So adding the word international to exhaustion is just a distraction, but don't worry, that's okay, because exhaustion is itself a distraction, and here's why. A patent is a right to exclude. So when a patentee sells her product, she is not using her patent. She is using a whole lot of other things, her property interest in whatever she's selling, but what she's not using is her patent. A patent is a right to exclude. So if you're not using your patent when you sell your patented product, how are you using it up? And exhaustion means you've used it up. So the exhaustion doctrine is itself a misnomer. Now, that doesn't mean that the doctrine is baseless. The doctrine really has a totally productive rooting, and the root of the exhaustion doctrine is its alternative name. The alternative name is first sale, and first sale really is a doctrine about what licensing terms get implied into contracts over stuff bought from IP owners. And that doctrine says if you buy something from a patentee, you probably thought you were also buying a license to use whatever you bought. So first sale is about implied rights to use what you've bought, but we all know how to get around implication, and that's to be explicit. So when people are clear that they're not buying a license, courts should not impose licenses. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dave Salmons, chair of the Bingham McCutcheon Appellate Practice Group. David was an assistant solicitor general of the United States, where he argued 14 cases before the United States Supreme Court. Let's hear from him.
Thank you, Judge. Well, I'm going to focus on a couple of Supreme Court cases that many of you will be familiar with. One is the Quanta versus LG Electronics case, and the other is the Costco v. Omega case from this last term. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the issues that have arisen related to the first sale doctrine or the doctrine of exhaustion. They're sort of mirror images of one another. In those cases, and tell you a little bit about what I think, how they play out in the cases that are still developing in this area. I'm going to bring more of a generalist perspective, more of a practitioner's perspective, because that's what I am. And I think it's important to start with just the realization that these issues related to these so-called gray goods arise because there is tremendous potential value to manufacturers and producers of patented and copyrighted works in seeking to control the secondary markets for their products. At the same time, there is tremendous value to consumers, distributors, retailers, and others, perhaps most notably e-commerce in today's age, in ensuring the free alienability of goods in secondary markets. Now, to date, the law has generally disfavored attempts by producers and manufacturers to control those secondary markets through doctrines such as patent exhaustion and the first sale doctrine and copyright. These doctrines, as been described, hold that intellectual property interests of the producer entitled to control the terms of the first sale of the patented or copyrighted work, but that after that first sale, it's the property rights of the purchaser that become paramount. And the purchaser can sell or dispose of the product in any subsequent transaction without regard to the interests of the producer. Now, at least in the Quanta case, the Supreme Court was very wary of limiting the doctrine of patent exhaustion in a way that would allow its application to turn on a factor that producers have substantial control over, on the fear that producers will manipulate the doctrine and render it largely meaningless. Thus, in Quanta, the court rejected an argument that exhaustion principles should be limited to apparatus patents and should not apply to method patents. The court noted that in many instances, the line between the two forms of patents is very blurry, and that, this is a quote, patentees seeking to avoid patent exhaustion could simply draft their patent claims to describe a method rather than an apparatus. The court rejected a construction that could lead to an end run around the exhaustion doctrine. In Costco v. Omega, the court was confronted with a similar problem involving the first sale doctrine under the Copyright Act. Now, as a technical legal matter, the question presented in that case was how to construe Section 109A of the Copyright Act, which codifies the first sale doctrine. It states that the owner of a particular copy or phono record lawfully made under this title, or any person authorized by such owner, is entitled without the authority of the copyright owner to sell or otherwise dispose of the possession of the copy or phono record. The dispute was whether the phrase lawfully made under this title carried with it a geographic limitation that excluded copies made outside the jurisdiction of the United States. The manufacturer, Omega in that case, and the Ninth Circuit agreed that the manufacturer argued that because the Copyright Act only applies and has force in the United States. A copy is only lawfully made under the Act if it's made in the United States. The reseller argued that legally made under the Act means only that the copy did not violate the Act, and the language imposes no geographic limitation at all. It also pointed out that there's no conceivable purpose in Congress favoring goods manufactured abroad and giving them a greater right to control secondary markets than is granted domestically produced goods. So the Supreme Court took up the case and split 4-4 with Justice Kagan recusing herself because the case was pending in the Solicitor General's office during her tenure there. Now, there were a variety of textual arguments that can be and were made related to how to construe the phrase lawfully made under this title, based on everything from dictionary definitions to legislative history to how the same phrase is used in other parts of the Act, as well as how the first sale doctrine in Section 109 overlapped and interacts with the importation provisions of Section 106. Thankfully, I'm not going to go through all those today. This is what lawyers are paid to fight about, and these are important arguments in the often unsatisfying search for congressional intent. But there's another important principle that I think is worth keeping in mind, and that's what I want to just conclude with today. And that is, it's the one that the court identified in Quanta, namely that given the incentives for manufacturers and producers to seek to control secondary and downstream markets, you ought not to construe those important limiting doctrines in a way that would have them turn on a factor that is substantially in the control of the producer, lest you risk an end run around the limitation. In Quanta, that factor was that factor that was subject to manipulation was whether the patentee's claims described a method or an apparatus patent. In copyright, in the Costco case, that factor was the place of manufacture. And the ability to manipulate that factor brings with it the added risk that you create yet another incentive for manufacturers and producers to produce their goods overseas, thus potentially negatively impacting not only secondary markets, but the economy more generally. I submit that it's very difficult to believe that Congress intended to create such an incentive, especially through a simple reference to copies being lawfully made under the Act. That's, I think, especially true because the Copyright Act has a long history of disfavoring goods that were made abroad. And at the same time Congress added the phrase lawfully made under this Act, it phased out an express place of manufacture provision that discriminated against books that were produced overseas. These issues continue to work their way through the courts. A divided panel of the Second Circuit recently joined the Ninth Circuit in reading a place of manufacture element in the Copyright Act's first sale doctrine. The Second Circuit panel was troubled with the result, emphasized how close a statutory construction question it was, and all but pleaded with Congress to clear it up once and for all. Perhaps Congress will, but in the meantime, we'll just have to wait for an appropriate case, perhaps this Second Circuit case, and see what Justice Kagan has to say about it. Thank you.
Our third speaker will be Professor David Olson. Professor Olson's assistant professor at Boston College. Before entering academia, he was a practicing patent litigator at a rather prominent firm of Kirkland & Ellis.
Thank you, Judge. It's great to be here. I'm going to dive in a little bit, say some general things and then into some specifics after the issues have already started to be lined up rather nicely by the first two speakers. So first, at a general level, right, to me it seems that there's kind of three main questions we're thinking about today for this panel. First, is price discrimination good, or can it be good, or when is it good? If it's always bad, then we shouldn't allow, we shouldn't facilitate restrictions on parallel importation, right? So that's the first question, and Scott already spoke to that some. Secondly, if it is good in some cases, how do we allow it in patent and copyright and trademark law? How do we do it currently? How could we do it better? Third, what should the limits on any ability to control, to internationally price discriminate be? And I think there's a couple main worries there. One, of notice and fairness, and secondly, antitrust concerns. So that's kind of the areas I want to talk about. And just to add to what Scott was saying about price discrimination, right? I mean, a quick example, kind of from the cases that David talked about. One example of price discrimination from the Lonza, the Quality King case, is a U.S. manufacturer manufactures shampoo in the U.S., sells it with a lovely botanical label on the bottle. That label gets to be copyrighted. The shampoo, of course, is not copyrighted, nor is it patented. The shampoo, anyone could copy the formula and sell it. But anyway, Lonza sells the shampoo for a high price in the U.S., doing lots of marketing to kind of pump up demand for that, but also says, hey, we could sell some in Europe for a lower price, and it's still above our marginal cost. Why not do that? So Lonza sells some in Europe. Then jobbers, people in Europe, figure out they can pick up the shampoo at the price there, re-import it into the U.S., sell it at a medium price, and make profit. Of course, Lonza doesn't like that at all because it wants to only sell at the high price in the U.S. And the question here is, right, should Lonza be able to stop that from happening or should it not? Another example would be watchmakers. Someone makes a watch, let's say this time in Switzerland, sells it again for a high price in the U.S. where there's a lot of demand for that brand of watch, sells it, say, for a lower price in Europe. Again, someone imports it, say, I don't know, Costco starts selling it in the U.S. For a cheap price or a medium price. And in this case, the watch manufacturer, again, doesn't like this. And one response to this would be, well, too bad you don't like it. You know, raise your prices if you don't like it. But, you know, what we should recall, especially when we think about intellectual property law and the subsequent copyright patent, what the court used to call monopolies that goes with that, is that what we're trying to do is incentivize production or incentivize innovation, right, and creation of expressive works. And the way we do this is by giving an exclusive right. And usually, I'd say most economists, not all, but most economists agree, once you've given someone monopoly power, it's good to let them then utilize the monopoly power in the most efficient way possible. Often the most efficient way possible is to price discriminate. So, you know, if we say you can control, you can keep people from parallel importation, from bringing in these watches or the shampoo at these prices, then Lonza or then Omega will go ahead and sell the goods at two different prices. Omega or Lonza will make more money, but consequently also lower valued users now get to buy this, you know, lovely shampoo with a botanical label on it, or the purchasers of watches, which of course in the Omega case, what was the IP? It wasn't the watch, it wasn't a patent, it was if you took the watch off and you looked on the back, there was a little Omega symbol, which I'm surprised no one actually, this isn't an Omega watch, I wasn't able to make it to Costco in time to afford one, so this is different. But, you know, it's this little symbol, and people are just using copyright as the hook to allow this kind of parallel importation. So in some ways, a critique could be, wait a minute, these aren't people getting their full return for the copyrighted good. They're just using it as a hook for parallel importation. Nevertheless, there's a lot to be said for the benefits, or to prevent parallel importation. There's a lot to be said for the benefits of price discrimination, particularly if you're kind of, if you care about wealth inequality, if you care about poor people globally, then maybe you should really like price discrimination because it means we can charge high prices for drugs for U.S. citizens and we can provide them for cheap or even free to other places in the world without worries that they'll then be re-imported back and destroy kind of the profits that can be made here. So those are some thoughts on that. How does the IP law facilitate international price discrimination? Patent law is territorial, so you have a Japanese patent, you have a U.S. patent, you can license someone to sell and make under the Japanese patent, not on the U.S. patent, and therefore try to prevent some parallel importation. Copyright law, as David was just pointing out, with Section 602A, gives an explicit right to control importation, and of course the question in Costco v. Omega and others is how that conflicts with the first sale doctrine. I think the case was probably rightly decided by the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit, although the statute is just a mess. It's a mess. Congress needs to rewrite it because it's ambiguous and unclear. But both these doctrines serve purposes. Then when we ask what should be the limitations on them, I'm running out of time, but I think what we should look at is, well, when do we have worries about notice issues or fairness issues? That's what should shape our limitations. Or when are these, when are manufacturers or others using these for antitrust, anti-competitive purposes, in which case antitrust law can come in. So now, to answer the judge's question in the minute I have left, I think when the judge buys a watch in Japan, let's say there's a Japanese patent, let's say it's patented, or maybe it's copyrighted, maybe it has a lovely face. Either way, there's a patent, let's say in this case. If it's a Japanese patent, he should have bought it with an implied license to have all rights to use it under that patent. He could get it repaired in Japan. Then he brings it back to the U.S. That's what makes the question tricky. Say there's a separate U.S. patent. There shouldn't be any implication that he bought it with the right to use it under the U.S. law. So I think in that case, we could argue that it is infringing when he enters the country and when he gets it repaired. It's infringing every day he wears it around because he's using it. This is a little bit troubling, right? This raises the issue of notice. He probably didn't have any notice of this, and so that might worry us, and we might want to have some restrictive doctrines. On the other hand, as Scott pointed out, I'm not really worried that people are going to come out and try to sue the individual consumer who will be out there wearing the watches. What they're going to try to do is, if someone is importing and letting Costco distribute the watches, that's who they're going to go after. So as a practical matter, maybe the problem disappears.
Thank you. Our last speaker is Sherwin Sly, who is the Deputy Legal Director at the Public Knowledge Foundation, where he focuses on emerging copyright issues. Sherwin.
Thank you. So I think I focus mostly on copyright issues, as you heard, and so I want to focus on the first sale doctrine as it appears in copyright law. I think I do want to respond a little bit to some of what my other fellow panelists have said at first before continuing with sort of my introductory remarks. I think it's interesting when you look at, you know, what the questions we are facing here. When I look at the first sale doctrine, my question is what it does for copyright law and why it has its place in copyright law. It's not necessarily a question of, you know, are we concerned with wealth distribution or access to goods? Are we concerned with allowing price discrimination? These are broader questions. But the question behind copyright law really is about incentivizing creation. And it's not about incentivizing creation of goods in general. It's about incentivizing the creation of creative works, a creative expression. And I don't think that reading the first sale doctrine and the way that it's been read in Costco versus Omega leads to that incentivizing that creation. And maybe it increases the amount of value you can extract out of transactions with a watch. But the watch wasn't the copyrighted object. It was the symbol on it. The value in an Omega watch really isn't a logo on it. The value in a bottle of shampoo isn't the label on it. It's the goods itself. So I think that there's an actual, there is, if you want to be able to allow perfect price discrimination by a producer, copyright law is not the way you want to go about doing that. And one of the reasons behind that you don't want that to happen is because using the first sale doctrine in this way doesn't just allow price discrimination, it actually prevents alienability. And it's not just for that first importer or for that first seller. Because if we look at the way that exhaustion works in copyright, right, the question isn't merely about licenses. The point is, you know, as it was pointed out earlier, you know, a sale of a patented work might not itself be sort of using that work. But by definition in the statute of copyright law, a distribution of a copyrighted work is a use under Section 106. And that use can be enjoined, can be actionable under the copyright law. So any transfer of any copyrighted work, absent the application of first sale, becomes an infringement automatically. So by taking goods that are manufactured outside of this country, beyond the scope of that, to say that the first sale doctrine doesn't apply doesn't just mean somebody can't import a series of textbooks and then resell them. It also means that Judge Rader can't sell his watch that he's bought in Japan if it has a copyrighted logo in it. It means not just that he can't sell it, he can't even give it away or loan it or rent it or lease it. And that does something very strange and actually very to me, seems very wrong. So if you want to find a means for better price discrimination, this isn't the way to go. And I think that, you know, really what the first sale doctrine does in copyright law, it's funny because I think that first sale in copyright law is the misnomer, not and exhaustion might actually be more appropriate. Because the question really isn't about where that first sale occurred. The way the statute's framed certainly is was this copy of this work, was it made lawfully? And the question of whether, you know, it says lawfully made under this title, does that mean lawfully made under the laws of Title 17? Does it mean made, you know, it would have been lawful if it had been made, you know, in another country? Doesn't mean it was lawfully made in this country only. And we can get into the questions of that interpretation, you know, I think in panel discussions in the future. But what it means is what I think the first sale doctrine does, what exhaustion does, is it creates a way of dealing with the intersection between copyrights and the rights in personal property. Because copyrights are so pervasive, they last so long, and they're involved in so many transactions of goods, that if you, without carving out these personal property rights, you would actually have much higher friction transactions. And you do see lawsuits against small players along these lines. I think, you know, the origin story of the first sale doctrine is usually told as Bob's Merrill Company versus Strauss, right? A publisher has a book that they insist must be sold for a dollar or more. Macy's then, they have actually a legend inside it saying that this book must be sold for a dollar. No dealer is licensed to sell it at a lower price. Macy's actually sells it for 89 cents, and they're sued for copyright infringement. And that's sort of the origins of why we have the first sale doctrine, because the Supreme Court said we don't want to have this sort of control of chattels by the manufacturer throughout its entire lifetime as it passes from hand to hand. We don't want that. We don't want there to be this control by the manufacturer. We don't want there to be this transaction cost every single time you buy something that contains a copyrighted work. Are you going to want to have to trace that chain of title, gain the permission of the copyright holder? Because that, absent first sale doctrine, is what you would have to do. So a lot of times people like to look at the first sale doctrine as just an exception or limitation applying to the distribution right of copyrighted works. I think it's true that it is that, but it's rooted in much more than that. And there are pre-Bob's Merrill cases from 1894, from 1901, and so on, that involve slightly different fact patterns, that where people are, for example, somebody buys a bunch of scrap paper, a bunch of waste paper that was damaged in a fire at a book warehouse, and they reassemble these pages into actual books and then sell them. And the court finds that that's okay. They've bought these goods and gained the title to the goods, and they have the right to repair them. This has happened with books that were, with children's books that were water damaged. They even actually, in that case, the Seventh Circuit actually found that it was fine for them to recreate the covers of the books as well. And there have been other cases as well where people would take, you know, buy comics off the shelves, compile them, and sell them as double comics. And so I think that this shows us that there's something more at work here. And this was before the first sale doctrine, as we now know it, was codified in the 1909 Act and then recodified again in the 76 Act. But I think this shows that at the root of the first sale doctrine is not just sort of a neat sort of carve-out in the distribution right, but a real understanding that once I have bought a thing, once I have bought a book, this copy of that book is mine to do with as I please. And I shouldn't let the hand of the copyright owner reach across however many transactions from before and stop my dealing with it. So I think that it's important for us to understand not just sort of what our broader policy goals might be in commerce, but also what our broad policy goals are in copyright and the purpose of the laws that we're trying to use to accomplish these goals. I think that there's one last sort of thing I just want to touch on, and I did want to mention a couple of cases. I won't go into too many details, but a big question that keeps coming up is what happens with copyrights and software, because every time you use a piece of software, a copy of it is made into the memory of your computer. So that isn't dealt with in, you know, as a reproduction, not a distribution. It's not dealt with in Section 109's first sale doctrine. Now, there's a separate provision in the law, Section 117, that says if you buy a piece of software, if you're the owner of that copy, you can make all of the copies that are necessary to run, to use that program. Now, what happens in pretty much every single piece of software that's ever sold is you have this long end user license agreement that comes along with it. And in that fine print is also a statement that says, you're merely licensing this software, you are not buying it. And that, according to the Ninth Circuit Court in Verner v. Autodesk in MDY versus Blizzard, controls what the characteristics of that transaction were. It doesn't matter what I thought when I walked into a store, picked a box off the shelf, put it on the register, and paid for it. Even if I think that that's a transaction that is a sale, that makes me the owner of this copy, not of the copyrights in the disk, but of the disk itself, regardless of what I think, that means that whatever I do, anytime I use that piece of software, I'm infringing copyrights unless I obey all of the terms of that end user license agreement. Now, this is a means by which you can escalate what would be a simple breach of contract into a copyright violation. And again, I think what you're seeing here is a particular set of laws and rules in copyright that are fairly ubiquitous, but because they are ubiquitous, can be used to affect a purpose that they weren't intended to. Thanks.
Let's go through each speaker again and give them 2 minutes to respond to each other or give their additional thoughts, and then we'll go to you with questions, or I have a couple. Professor Keefe?
Well, thank you very much, and I greatly enjoyed the comments from the other panelists. I guess one question I would ask is, when you buy a very, very expensive watch or camera or other device, and it has a logo on it, my guess would be that if you brought it into a repair shop owned by the company who is associated with that logo, and they told you, well, you don't have exactly the right logo, and so we will not stand by the wonderful ironclad solid gold warranty you expect, take your watch and good luck. You'd be quite annoyed. Those logos actually are terribly important. It's nice to trivialize them, except everybody realizes they matter a ton. When you buy a very expensive piece of equipment, you're buying not just what you think you get when it arrives on your doorstep, but the whole set of service and quality that will last after that point, and the relationship between the intellectual property right and the control, which is the word everyone keeps using, is so essential to allowing that follow-up service. Absent the service, absent the quality, much lower price, much worse for everybody. So I know it's nice to trivialize it. It just turns out logos do matter, and if you think they don't, just ask your fellow trademark lawyer. I guess it's okay to imagine somebody saying, hey, I want to walk into a McDonald's and I want to get a totally different quality hamburger, a totally different quality shake. That's not why you go to McDonald's. If you want a different quality, you go to a different brand. So there really are customer values here that are respected by enforcing the IP and by enforcing the relationship between the IP owner and the distributors.
Let's go on to David.
Sure. I just would add a couple things. One that I don't think we've addressed enough is the potential transaction costs that get added on to every subsequent transaction in secondary markets across the board if you're not very clear about the rights of the purchaser. You take eBay, for example, and all of the goods that are sold there, I don't know how many transactions a day. How are you supposed to know where a good was manufactured? How are you supposed to know under what terms it was? There are tremendous value. This is a big part of the economy. Secondary markets make up a substantial amount of aspects of the economy. You need those to be efficient as well as creating incentives for the creation of the goods in the first instance. And that's the balance that gets struck. It's not one-sided. It is the rights of the purchaser and the normal property rights associated with that that get built into the system. And if you allow things that are just added into some of these lease agreements and the like, or if you make a turn on things that nobody can know, like where it was produced half the time, you're really increasing the transaction costs for those secondary markets.
Thank you. David?
Yes, so a couple of thoughts. First off, Sherwin asked if we could be sure. You said, you know, with exhaustion law and first sale, you know, who could Judge Rader sell his watch? Could he even give it away? I'll take it, Judge. So if you've got it here, I'm not particularly worried about being sued afterwards that, let's say it's Omega or whoever it was that you bought the watch brand. I'm not worried they're going to be suing. Which kind of goes to what Scott was saying. Another thought that I had, Sherman talked about the without the first sale, once there's been a sale, the rights of the purchasers become paramount. And I don't really understand what that means. I mean, I just don't know what it means. And it also makes me think, you know, I might be quite willing to pay a much lower price in exchange for lots of restrictions, right? I'm not a professional carpenter. You sell me a drill for much cheaper. I promise I won't use it on construction job sites. I mean, that, you know, to some people might seem terribly unfair, but I might be really happy to get the drill for a quarter of the price if I agree to those restrictions. And if I, as the consumer, being made better off, if we come along with this philosophy that says, no, you're being hurt because once the purchase happened, your rights have to become paramount, I might start saying, no, I liked the rights I had when he was able to restrict me more, right? So if we're thinking about consumer welfare, I think it's, I agree with Scott that thinking about in terms of rights of control and just talking about the language without thinking about the actual effects and economics of it can be a little misleading. I'll stop there.
Sure, Mike.
Thanks. I think, you know, what I wonder is when are we going to rely upon principle and when are we going to be realistic? I think having a system in which every single person who deals in secondhand goods or who gives things away being potentially liable is not tenable. Whether or not you expect to be prosecuted for it. If you have the ability to sue somebody for this, it's going to be abused in some sense, in some way, when it's something that somebody can just throw on in another complaint. For example, I mean, the question of whether or not you can add value to something by having a brand and a quality that you stand behind, well, that's actually not a question of copyright. It's a question of trademark. And what we're dealing with, and yet, Costco versus Omega wasn't filed as a trademark suit. And if we are going to be asking about, you know, sort of the practicalities of a situation and not just sort of the potential eventualities, then I think the question of what happens when you have an extremely long and detailed contract as a matter of just ordinary business practice attached to every single piece of software sold, let's be realistic. How many of those are read? How many of those are read and understood? And what are the transaction costs for every single user in that market, right? There's a question of, well, you know, we have these doctrines and we have commerce still continuing, but when we're talking about copyrighted goods and not necessarily just patents, but I think patents as well, the question is how much of the market do you want to be able to participate freely in this exchange? Those transaction costs do exist, and they do prevent smaller actors from engaging in that market.
Thank you. Questions from many of you? Please, young lady, would you use the microphone here so we get a transcript? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Christina Mulligan. I'm a fellow at Yale Law School. I noticed an asymmetry in the way we treat intellectual property and tangible property law, and so I'd love to ask you guys to comment on that in light of maybe a way of recasting the discussion we've had. If we look at the way, there's a difference in how we treat property and contract historically under the law. In contract, you can contract with someone for any combination of things that you want, whereas property, historically, you've had to convey in very limited ways, and you couldn't run servitudes on things in tangible property at all, and in real property in any but a limited number of ways. And so in light of that, I want to point out an asymmetry in how we're treating tangible property law and intellectual property law that's brought out by this discussion. So with patents and intellectual property, digital software and digital copyright, intellectual property owner has a lot of ability to dictate future uses and transfers. Whereas intangible property, the widget factory maker, once the widget is sold, can't, as a matter of law, dictate what happens to the widget because we're valuing the property rights of the widget buyer in this sort of traditional property way. And so what I'm wondering is, does this asymmetry bother you? And if not, why the difference between how we want to approach tangible property and how we want to approach intellectual property?
Sure. So I think the difference is less to do with whether it's tangible and intangible and more to do with the other points you were making, which is that we did, in fact, historically have many more reservations about complexity in property because it is in rem, which is to say it is enforceable against all third parties, and there are big information costs if you, a random third party, could encounter an asset, and that asset could be encumbered by a whole bundle of restrictions, and you'd be so confounded and so surprised, and this is before the day of the interweb, and you couldn't look it up on Westlaw, and it was all hard. And that makes total sense. It just turns out that yesteryear was quite a long time ago. And in fact, most of us live in co-ops and condos and in high-density urban environments where the number of restrictive covenants that do run with the land are so totally far more complex than that, that to view that distinction as one between tangible and intangible is to ignore the complexity of New York City, Washington, D.C., or in fact, even many farming communities. So this is a problem that comes with the modern world, not a problem that comes with IP. And indeed, IP assets disappear over time, admittedly copyright quite slowly, but patent quite quickly, trademarks quite quickly if they fall out of use. And so to the extent these things are valuable, one should not be surprised that they have some complexities.
Is part of the answer here that the patent is of limited duration?
Yeah, so part of the answer is that patents are short in time. Part of the answer is that the concern about transaction costs, surprise, manipulation, it's worth noticing that in the Quanta VLG case, the party who was so upset about being encumbered by these very, very complicated terms were themselves the authors of those terms. Very, very sophisticated parties, advised by very, very good counsel. There was, on the facts of the case, no surprise, nor was there any surprise for any of the other third parties in the case. In fact, it was essentially this deal. I walk into a complicated store with hundreds of Wall Street lawyers advising me about what to do, and I say, "Would you please sell me a slice of bread?" Everybody involved in watching the transaction knows that the price paid is for the slice, and later the Supreme Court says no, the whole loaf was transferred because of concerns about surprise.
Can I push back a little bit on what you just said? So there's always been greater flexibility in real property because it's a much bigger decision. People own less real property, but we all own thousands and thousands of tangible objects. In a world where those would be encumbered by massive use restrictions, it would be impossible to know what they were. And so that's why we still have this prohibition, basically complete prohibition on non-possessory property interests in tangible goods. And to say that's silly, or to say that that's not going to be a problem in a patent or a software context seems like it's being sort of willfully blind to the fact that in reality we do buy, like individuals buy many different programs that have long terms of service, EULAs, and even small business owners will buy patented products, maybe several, maybe one or two.
Okay, we've got your point.
So the lawsuits, remember, the lawsuits are not against the individual owners, especially in the patent context. In the copyright context, that risk is quite sharp, but that's only because of criminal liability and statutory damages, both of which I happen to oppose because they are so totally orthogonal to a property system. But in the patent system, where you actually have the private owner bear the cost of enforcement, you get radical under enforcement in a socially attractive way. So these lawsuits, in other words, the lawsuits against Costco, Costco's not a small little guy. Costco can afford tons of lawyers. They're quite sophisticated. So let me just wrap up with this final image. Resale price maintenance. I mean, if Ligon, the Supreme Court case talking about why we in fact should be much more open to viewing rule of reason treatment for resale price maintenance, if you really had the strong views that you're expressing and that Sherwin is expressing and that David Solomons are expressing, you should be out there aggressively saying that every time any franchise arrangement is struck, there's a kind of fundamental infringement on freedom of both the seller, the franchise operator, and the poor customer who goes into a Burger King or McDonald's because she can't get her hamburger unencumbered by McDonald's wrappers.
There's a smaller secondary market in hamburgers, but...
You'll find franchises over stuff other than food.
Okay. Thank you. Let me ask... I started with one hypothetical. Let me throw a hypothetical from the other perspective, a very real hypothetical. I'm the owner of one of the 30 prominent AIDS treatment drugs. And I would dearly love to sell them into South Africa for 25 cents a pill. Of course, I sell them in New York City for $5 a pill. Now, if I'm not allowed to put some restriction on the re-import of the 25-cent pill, of course, it will come back and destroy my market. It cost me $1 billion to make that drug, probably $10 billion. I won't even recover the cost of my drug. And of course, I will also, if I'm forced to live with the first sale principle, not then be able to help the people of South Africa by giving them a price cut. How do we deal with that hypothetical in this world?
Well, I think, you know, one of the questions is also, by what means do you want to deal with that hypothetical? By what structures of law are you trying to enforce these agreements? I think a lot of the things that we've been talking about in terms of granting flexibility in the deals between a consumer and a producer are, you know, perfectly, you know, cognizable under contract law.
Do I remember correctly that there were contract provisions in the Quanta case which the Supreme Court did not give much cognizance to? And if that's the case, then I don't think you answered my question. Am I right on that?
You are right.
Absolutely, Chief.
If I can't, by contract, say I want to help the people of South Africa by giving them this pill for less than it costs me to produce it, but I want to help them, what have we done to South Africa, and what have we done to the overall principles of the law here?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, picking up on Sherwin's point, I do think you have to, I mean, I'm certainly not taking the position that none of these kinds of values can be accommodated. I think the problem is, as the law exists today, and as some of the parties, for example, in some of these cases are trying to get the courts to interpret the law a certain way, you end up with just a mess on your hands. For example, the Supreme Court has already held in the Quality King case that if it just so happens that the good is manufactured in the United States and then sold abroad, and then brought back in the United States, the first sale doctrine applies, and you cannot do that. And it reconciled the importation provision of the Copyright Act with the first sale doctrine and gave a broader construction to the first sale doctrine. In that case, my guess is then some of the panelists here would like. But that is, in fact, what the law is now. My point is that if you take that is the baseline. This is why this requires a much broader rework by Congress, and it's not something that the courts can do. You're stuck with this now. There's these sort of technical questions about how do you construe the act. But if you do it wrong, you create really perverse incentives, I think, in terms of where things are manufactured, like that is just far beyond anything Congress could have imagined.
And I'm happy to cede expertise in patent law to Judge Rader or the panel, but in the case of copyright law, let's take the example of, let's say you're trying to sell textbooks in a developing country. You would like to charge less for them. If you're charging, vastly reduced prices for the textbooks, it's still not the case that you're going to have to prevent all importation of those textbooks in order to maintain a market. In order to maintain a profit margin that's going to allow you to continue publishing both in the United States and internationally.
Question from the audience?
Thanks, Judge. Actually, I was going to clarify on one point in your hypothetical, Your Honor, because one of the points is that pharmaceuticals are a unique product that they ban importation of those drugs. So even if you wanted to transship drugs, because of the unique character of U.S. law, you simply can't do so legally. Only manufacturers are permitted to import those drugs. The second part of that is why the rationale exists. The wisdom of the Capitol Hill was that there's a unique health and safety rule in that feature for the government to step in, where the bundle of rights that come with the product, where a knockoff or some other kind of violation of the copyright product could endanger the health and safety of the public.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Maybe there's a significant difference between widgets and other kinds of things we think of as personal property that you have the ability to alienate as you see fit once you purchase them, from things like pharmaceuticals, where nobody thinks you can just turn around and resell the drugs you've just been, right.
And that's actually a facet of U.S. law that I've actually broadly disagreed with. I don't see any problem with the idea of, because we're not really talking about South America very much when we talk about that. We're talking about, a little nearer economy just north of the border. I happen to own a Hitachi excavator that was made in Canada, and I have it down here. Unfortunately, Hitachi hasn't come and told me or sued me to tell me I can't start it. So I'm quite glad about that, but when it comes to drugs, I mean, my concern again is about who was doing the enforcing. We missed essentially the teaching moment, the concept that look, there the enforcement mechanism is if you're selling to Canada at a break, and they start wholesale shipping drugs to the United States, you stop selling them. And if they threaten you to break your patent, let them do it, and you take them to the world court. In other words, it's transparent, it's understood. Instead, you have a system. At least as I can currently see, in which people in America, the average people, can't understand why is that drug more expensive, and why is a constable at the border or watching my purchases on the internet to prevent me from getting this? The situation never plays out, and I don't think that the public is educated or served by that type of thing. And on the drill hypothetical, that exists, but the biggest problem here, and this works for the drug thing as well, I mean, it's distinguishment. You spoke about, look, your Omega's different, we're not going to service it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. There are people who make identical drills, and they sell some to hobbyists and they sell some to contractors. And one drill says Ryobi on it, and the other says Rigid. And they're made by the same company. I mean, this is so simple. There's virtually no cost to people to make these arrangements. It's almost self-enforcing.
Sir? You have a question?
Yeah. Well, that's observations, obviously. But I'm wondering why you don't think basically manufacturing this stuff so it's distinguishable, then allows for the price discrimination. To follow the distinguishment, and that either would cut down on the enforcement problems or make them go away.
So you're right. I mean, manufacturers could have different brands, and they've done that, you know, in lots of ways. Why? Partly because of antitrust rulings, which would have made it illegal for them to price discriminate, right? Clayton Act. It's only recently that the court has allowed resale price maintenance and has said tying can be okay. So that's part of it. But each of these would involve a transaction cost, right? So it's more expensive to take your shampoo, make a separate label, put it in a bottle. Not that much more expensive. It's more expensive to put a different back on the watch. Not that much more expensive, but it's a bit more expensive. And so if there's a good reason to make the manufacturers do that, and maybe for notice reasons there is, then that could be okay. But, you know, a thought I had in listening to the fellow panelists is I totally agree with David. I mean, the 109, 602A, 106, the interaction there is very confused, and the statute's terrible, and the way it's interpreted right now does give an incentive to move your manufacturing overseas, because only then can you price discriminate, at least if you're in the Ninth or the Second Circuits. That's nuts. That can't be what Congress intended. I'm not a big, you know, try to read the tea leaves of what was legislative intent, but even I will say that can't be what Congress intended, and they need to wade back in. So let me throw out a friendly amendment if Congress is wading back in here. What if Congress were to say, we will allow you to control importation, so we will allow you to prohibit people from importing the watch, the shampoo, whatever, but we'll have a personal use exception. So someone for their personal use buys a product in another country, they can bring up to five back in, right? We have those sorts of exceptions right now with regard to certain IP laws. I think that would take care of a lot of the issues that Sherwin's raising. And then we'd really, I think the issue that'd be left would be, I don't know how you feel about this, David, but, well, would still allow someone to stop Costco, people selling on eBay goods that they've bought overseas and selling them in bulk. I'm okay with that, but maybe you're not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm approaching this far more from a legal perspective than a policy perspective in some ways, just given my interest and my background in this and sort of from the standpoint of how do the courts deal with these kinds of problems. I would just add along the lines of that comment that a lot of the problems are Congress made because the statute's a mess. A lot of it's the Supreme Court, too, because in some of the prior cases there's been dicta and other kinds of things that have only added to the confusion, and now they've got themselves in this situation where they have to try to figure out what to do about it. And
but they're working with it. They're working with a terrible statute, though.
They are. No, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, I think there's a judgment to be made. I guess the point I would make is there is a significant benefit and value to the alienability of goods that are purchased and the secondary markets that accompany those and the way in which goods and services can be distributed through those secondary markets. And I think you have to balance that out. And I don't have a strong opinion, to be honest with you, where that is. Is it 5? Is it 100? Is it something else? You know, I don't know. But I think it's a mistake to only think about it in terms of maximizing the profit for the producer. Because at some point, the incentives are there good enough, consistent with the underlying goals of copyright and patent law to get the benefit that was intended.
But what about Judge Rader's point? Just change it from drugs to insulin pumps for diabetics, or to blood monitoring pumps, or any medical devices that wouldn't have the separate treatment. I mean, how do you deal with the situation that if you really do away with this ability to restrict imports, now we can't sell to poor people?
Well, but you might be able to, just you won't get the quite as high a profit as you would otherwise. And the question is, do you see no benefit in the arbitrage? Do you see no good that's created in the lower prices? You know, do you shop at Costco? I mean, I don't know.
Are you concerned with the overall value of the system, or are you concerned with the maximum distribution of the product?
No, wait, time out. Time out. We're talking about voluntary interactions with, in fact, no surprise by the very, very, very sophisticated party, Costco, or LG Electronics, and Quanta, and Intel. I mean, these are really, really well-lubricated, well-lawyered, well-lobbied, well-financed entities. There's no shock, no surprise, none of the poor customer cowering underneath his bed, afraid of being sued for secondary market infringement. These are really big, sophisticated players.
Until those products actually make it into this country and are bought by consumers, then does that covenant still run with that chattel? Because the way it's been phrased in Costco v. Omega, it certainly does.
And that's crazy, too. I mean, the American Library Association and, in fact, Omega's own brief, both would have had, it was an atextual interpretation of the statute, so that was problematic, but both would have said, once you have an authorized sale in the U.S., okay, we shouldn't get to control further sales. They really just want that ability to sell at one price in Germany and another price in the U.S., and they say, once somebody's imported it and we've authorized a sale here, no matter where it's manufactured, that should be that. I mean, because having it run does have all those notice problems
that
we talk about.
And then whatever value the IP owner manages to acquire, why do we have the normative view that the voluntary transaction entered into by the distributor somehow means that the distributor should get a lower price than the one they actually contract for voluntarily? In other words, all of these deals are, yes, we could imagine a high transaction cost world where the deals are not getting done. It just turns out these cases are getting brought because these deals are getting done all the time, and the buyers are then finding that by bringing the lawsuit arguing these fancy arguments, they can get a rebate for the deal they voluntarily struck. That's wonderful for my students. That's the Full Employment Act for lawyers. But that said, all that is moving money from one pocket to another. That's not making the pie bigger. That's adding transaction costs, not decreasing transaction costs.
What I think is interesting is if you're talking about the amount of value in the system, the fact that arbitrage is occurring means that there are more people within the United States willing to pay more money per watch than there are in, Belgium or wherever those watches were actually purchased. So it's not the same to say that you're interested about the overall value in the system and the maximum distribution
of those
watches.
That was my point. That's why I wonder if you really think there's no good that comes from the arbitrage, that there's no sort of broader public benefit from it. Because it seems to me that you can make the case that it is. Well, of course, arbitrage is voluntary. Nobody's forcing. I mean, it's arbitrary and well-incentivized. But it's all voluntary transactions.
No. I'm talking about the contract that was struck in Quanta VLG. In other words, that was voluntary, and both sides of that deal were reporting profits to their shareholders, and then after the case, one side got a rebate. In other words, it was that market functioned fine with the terms as is.
I was thinking of the overseas products being brought back in the United States, and that's why I was saying, there is, in some sense, some public benefit to being able to get goods at a cheaper price.
So then, just to shift gears, maybe take another glance at this. So I David Olson's suggestion for a very precise statutory number and a very precise statutory fix, I think is, at least that strikes me as very productive, and reasonable minds could disagree about whether the number should be 4 or 8, but that strategy is very productive. That being said, it is a strategy that having now championed it, let me raise some questions about it. It's a strategy that should remind us all that there are some basic differences between patents and copyrights that answer the questions you were asking first about the difference between property and contract. Copyright speaks in terms of governance. It is highly textured, and that means that whoever is writing that statute at that time ought to have really, really good information about what the members of society of tomorrow would like to do with their stuff. And if you have a high degree of confidence that people up on the hill are going to make that decision right prospectively, then you want approaches of that type. I'm totally skeptical of that. And what I like about the patent and generally trademark approach, as distinguished from the copyright approach, is that patent approach is much more of a property in rem, right of exclusion speaking approach. It's an approach that says, we're not going to try to say that you as a patentee have the right to do A, B, C, and D, and the right to license people to do A, B, C, and D. We're just going to give you a broad right of exclusion. And then you decide who to exclude from doing what, on what terms.
and the cost of enforcement is borne by you, the property owner, and there are no criminal liabilities and no statutory damages, so you're going to have to plead and prove actual damages. And what do we see in the patent system? Massive quantity of low-value infringement happening all over the place, and property owners in the patent system let it happen. And by the way, that's totally consistent with real property, right? We can, you can be a person on the street and walk into the Mayflower Hotel, a private property, tangible property, and the owner isn't standing there with a ticket collector or a shotgun shooting you unless you have the right ticket. So property owners, when property rights are well structured, actually achieve all the fair use goals that we're debating without us having to debate them, because the owners modulate that in a very intelligent way by paying attention to where the value is.
Let's and take the last question from the floor. I think we're getting near the end.
Thank you, Judge. I think you should come to some of the panels. No surprise that I mostly agree with Professor Keefe on the structure and what the rights of the patent or copyright holder would be. My question would be, taking Judge Rader's hypothetical somewhat in reverse, there's certainly a value to providing low-cost drugs to people of South Africa or, you know, Zimbabwe or South America or wherever else. The question, I suppose, is then how do we go, when we come back to the United States, how do we present that political question to the public at large? Precisely because they say, look, it's an American company that spent $10 billion to manufacture this drug, and not only are we giving it away for free or nearly for free to South Africa, but we're also giving it at a low cost to Germany, Italy, Canada, France, whoever else. And not only that, we are not then allowed to re-import it back and benefit from the same low cost. It strikes a lot of people as unfair. How do we sort of deal, I mean, obviously there's an intellectual way to do it, but that doesn't really, this panel discussion doesn't really sell well to the public at large, right?
So here's a totally straightforward way to deal with the problem. Rather than rent control, why not have the city go to the landlord, rent the apartment, turn around and say to the poor tenant, we will provide it to you at whatever price you can afford. That would be a very explicit way for society to intervene on behalf of the poor and to give the property owner a fair value for the asset, which will then provide more than adequate incentives for the property owner and the government and the rest of the market to make sure that the right number of apartment buildings are being built. You can do the same thing with IP domestically and internationally. So rather than worrying about playing a hide-the-ball game, having all these conversations about down-in-the-weeds IP, price discrimination, etc., why not have a totally transparent conversation publicly that says, we're going to take somebody's stuff, and we have a body of jurisprudence that deals with that. Takings law. We pay them a just compensation, but who's paying them? We, the public. So we, the public, know that we're paying somebody for their stuff. It's a very open and transparent way, and it's precisely because of transaction costs that we have that nifty little thing built into our Constitution that allows us to do that. So if we're going to take stuff, take it, pay for it, give it away to whoever you want, but do it openly and publicly.
We have just a few minutes. Let's give each of the speakers, we'll start with Sherwin and go backwards this time. We'll go give them each 1 minute to sum up.
I think I've made some of my points. I did want to touch upon a couple of things that just came up in the last couple of minutes. In terms of the constant low level of infringement that goes on, that might do well for sort of many repeat players in an industry. What happens when you have a new entrant into that industry that might actually be disruptive to that industry and have that same question of low-level sort of, you know, de minimis infringements becomes another question entirely if you can leverage those into an anti-competitive stance. As for the question of limited numbers of importations, I wonder, basically, are we going to be drawing a line at what size do we want to restrict a transaction? When is somebody basically too big to control their own property?
David?
Okay. Sorry, Minister Philanderson, the last Never mind.
He's
saying
the idea being that if you know you want
you're
to
allowing ex- five
you're allowing
why
five
not, 500,
what's
why
the difference
not
at what point are you drawing that distinction? Sure. Is it purely is your problem with it being commercial?
Yeah, no, because I'm arbitrary. That's why, and that's how we write laws, is we have lots of arbitrary numbers in them, and that seems like a good one, but I'm open to others. So going back to what I started out saying, is price discrimination good? I think it often can be. That's what some of us have argued up here. I'm disappointed to hear that the clear and compelling logic you don't think is going to play well with the public. I agree that the idea that we should be able to re-import drugs often gets a lot of political play. I think at the end of the day, it's bad economics and it's bad humanitarian policy, so I don't like it. And what would be the result? We would probably pay slightly lower drug prices in the U.S. and the rest of the world would pay higher, and we'd have less overall distribution of drugs. I mean, I think that's, unless the drug companies are getting the price discrimination terribly, terribly wrong, we'd have less overall distribution, which means less poor people get helped, and I'm kind of a humanitarian. That bothers me. When it comes, one other thing I wanted to mention, which kept coming up, all these transaction costs of having to keep track of whether there are any IP rights attaching to the book that you bought or the record or whatever it is. Yes, IP, those transaction costs are there. Every time they have to be monitored, they cost the manufacturer money. And so the manufacturer would rather just do a straight sale right up front and not have to worry about any further monitoring. And that's why most of the goods you buy are like that. Whether they're patent covered by patents or copyrights, you get to buy it, do whatever you want with it. But when it is worth it to the manufacturer to keep track of and to prohibit certain further uses or sales, it's really worth it to them. And what's that area? It's mostly software, right? So we have this myth where we treat software sales as if they're licenses. Why do we have this legal fiction? Because the courts have kind of just recognized it's so economically important to do that. I looked up this morning the price of AutoCAD, the computer-assisted drawing. If you're a student, you can get it for $200, 2012 AutoCAD from Autodesk. If you're a professional, you pay $4,000. Well, if we get rid of price discrimination, guess what students are going to pay? Do you think professionals are going to start paying $200? I don't think so, right? So the transaction costs, when they're there, are very important to deal with. And the last point I want to make is that as more and more goods are becoming digital, intangible, the cost of selling an additional unit, the marginal cost is approaching zero. And at that point, if we, whether it be territorial or otherwise, if we actually facilitate an ability to price discriminate, we could have much brighter distribution of goods, and we could have many more poorer people getting access to them.
David?
I guess 2 points. One, I think this discussion shows that any hope that the Supreme Court or even Congress, for that matter, anytime soon is going to bring some rationality to this is probably a pipe dream. We're going to continue to have quite a messy system on our hands, which I guess means it'll keep all of us employed criticizing it for a long time. The last point I would make is that the casebooks are full of examples going back as far as there have been manufacturers, of examples of producers trying to find some way to extend their hands further down the market line to get into secondary markets to assert as much control as possible over their goods. It's only natural that they would do so. But there is a recognition that there are other societal interests in play besides just maximizing their profits. That's the point of the first sale doctrine in the first instance. And
Scott?
I think we have to respect that too.
Final word.
So I guess two final thoughts. One is very rare for the average movie theater to be disrupted by violence as the high-paying young adults set upon the low-paying senior citizens and beat them up enraged at the political anger associated with price discrimination. We rose above it in that setting. We'll rise above it in others. Society will work. And I just think that when you look back at the old cases that have been mentioned many times where we are so skeptical about so-called downstream control, those were cases written about in the day when we had far less sophisticated views of markets and antitrust law than we did today. And those cases were essentially speaking in terms of antitrust, using views that today we have totally discarded, because we recognize that if you don't like a complicated relationship with vendor A,
you go with vendor B, that customers do have choices on the front end about whether they want these complicated arrangements or they don't, and that's where the competition is. It's whether you're going to have a complicated relationship with your vendor or a simple relationship with your vendor, and vendors compete with each other to give those business models.
Let's thank the panelists.
Very good. Great to do this.